Have you ever hung up the phone in anger or silently cried? If you have, that's restlessness. And it doesn't really matter who you are or where you're from, whether you're 16 or 60. We all long, don't we, for a better world and a better life. We imagine in our spare time perfect friends, the perfect marriage, the perfect family. We dream about the perfect job, the perfect house, and the perfect body shape. We hope for a perfect weekend, a perfect holiday, and a perfect retirement. And the list goes on. But we dream like that because we're restless. We imagine, think, and hope. But the reality is that we often mourn and cry, and we feel pain. And that's because we're a restless people. In fact, the evidence for this restlessness is everywhere. Husbands and wives struggle over the long term. Parents and children face years of falling out. Teenagers go to school living with a daily fear of bullying. For the majority of people, work is dull and meaningless. And our hearts inside of us are restless. We're full of greed and impatience and envy. Again, that list could go on. Do you see, the Bible is right, isn't it? We are a restless people. And a lot of the time it doesn't really bother us. We're too locked into our own busy schedules. We're distracted by the events of tomorrow. But some of us here this morning may be feeling restless, physically, emotionally, spiritually drained, tired in body, mind, and soul. Maybe you long for refreshment, recuperation, or relief. Well, if that is you this morning, please listen to the message of Exodus 16. This is where God himself begins to offer people rest. He gives a taste of rest here in the present. But more than that, he invites us to join him for a rest that will go on for eternity. Back in Exodus 14, connect guys, we'll catch you up. The people of Israel marched through the Red Sea on dry ground. There was a wall of water on their left and on their right, and Pharaoh's armies went charging in after them. But the Lord hurled the Egyptians into the sea. He brought the surging waters crashing back down on their heads. The Lord destroyed the Egyptians, and he delivered the Israelites. And now we're looking at chapters 15 through to chapter end of chapter 18. And we're with the people of Israel as they journey through the desert. They're headed towards this place called Mount Sinai, which will be a significant stop on their journey. And their final destination is the Promised Land. Exodus 16 verse 1 tells us that it's been about 6 weeks since the parting of the Red Sea. And there's been one big problem: grumbling against Moses. The people have grumbled about water, chapter 15, verse 24, and the whole community has grumbled about food, chapter 16, verse 2. And on both occasions, the Lord has provided. He turned this pool of bitter water into a pool of lemonade. He took them to an oasis with springs and shade. And he now rains down meat in the evenings and bread in the mornings. He gives them quail. Verse 13, these plump, lean, juicy birds. Jamie Oliver-style dining for the Israelites. The bread he provides covers the desert floor. It's sun-dried to perfection with a hint of coriander and honey. So throughout this section, we have the grumbling Israelites and the patient Lord. He just keeps providing for them. And now in the second half of chapter 16, the Lord gives his people two commands. First comes in verse 23, second in verse 32. And we're going to take these two commands as our two headings. So here's the first one. The Lord gives them a command to rest. A command to rest. Verses 21 to 30. The Lord's full of surprises. Just have a look at verse 21. Each morning, everyone gathered as much as they needed. That's the bread. And when the sun grew hot, it melted away. On the sixth day, they gathered twice as much, two omers for each person. And the leaders of the community came and reported this to Moses. Now try and imagine their daily routine. The sun rises early and light floods into each little tent. Two small children in one tent, Benjamin and Ruth, are already awake, and they hop out of their bed and they rush to the entrance to peer through the crack in the canvas. "Has the bread arrived yet?" one of them whispers. And there it is, this fresh manna, crusty on the outside, warm through to the centre, and their tummies start to rumble. Next thing they know, Dad is heading out with a group of other men to fill baskets of bread, enough for the day. And although there's plenty to go round, this is hard work. There's a million people, remember, to distribute this bread to. So when Dad finally arrives back at the tent, he's hot and bothered. He sits himself down and he says that the leaders have gone to see Moses. There's way more bread out there than normal. There's enough for at least 2 days. What he's got in his basket will do them for today, which is Friday, and for tomorrow, which is Saturday. And then a little bit later in the day, they're all washing their dinner down with this sweet water. And a messenger calls past the tent. He's got a word from Moses, a command from the Lord. It's big news. Look at verse 23. Moses said to them, "This is what the Lord commanded. Tomorrow is to be a day of Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. So bake what you want to bake and boil what you want to boil. Save whatever is left until morning." Do you see? Normally God provides them with enough food for each day. And if anyone stores it overnight, by the next morning it's crawling with maggots. The whole camp knows when you've ignored the Lord because your tent reeks. Unfortunately, a few people have already done that. But now, every Friday, the Lord will provide them with double the food. And it will last for 48 hours without rotting. And the reason for that is because he wants them to take Saturday off, to have a Sabbath, to have a rest. On the Saturday, there'll be no need to get up early, to go out into the scorching heat, to toil and labour, because the Lord will make sure there's plenty left over from the day before. That's exactly what happens. Look at verse 24. So they saved the bread until morning, as Moses commanded, and it didn't stink or get maggots in it. "Eat it today," said Moses, "because today is a Sabbath to the Lord. You won't find any of it on the ground. 6 days you're to gather it, but on the seventh day, the Sabbath, there won't be any." It's an amazing provision for the people of Israel. A day of rest. But for us this morning, knowing what to believe about the Sabbath is actually harder than we might imagine. Some Christians suggest that very little has changed since the days of Exodus, and that Sunday is now our Sabbath day. Other Christians argue that the Sabbath law was fulfilled in Jesus, and there's almost now complete freedom in our weekly routines. Lots has been written about these differences, and I'll come back to the theme of the Sabbath in a moment. But whatever our specific take on the do's and don'ts of Sunday, every Christian can agree that we are made out of dust. We need regular times of rest. God built order into the creation, 6 days on, 1 day off. And God's design in doing that wasn't to punish us or to drive us to boredom, but to provide for us. He knows what's best. Jesus said, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath." So you see, rest is a gift. According to the Bible, both work and rest have their place. Hard work is commended and rest is celebrated. For us, the difficulty is getting the balance right. I wonder if many of us here aren't quite as busy as we like to think. But life just feels constantly overwhelming because our days and our weeks and our months don't have this rhythm. One of the dangers of technology is that work and rest almost blend together. We dawdle on YouTube and Facebook at the office, and we catch up on emails in the lounge at home. We're never completely on, and we're never completely off. Bernard Lagat is a 4-time Olympian athlete from Kenya. He won medals and he holds records across a range of events, 1,500 metres, 5,000 metres. But apparently one of the secrets to his running is not running. After 11 months of intense training and competition, Legat puts his trainers in a wardrobe and he pigs out for 5 weeks. He does no running. He trains his son's football team and he puts on weight. And he says that rest is a good thing. Even the best need rest. In fact, they wouldn't be the best without rest. So life isn't a sprint. But life isn't a marathon either. Life is much more like circuit training. We do shuttle runs and then break. We do press-ups and then break. We do squats and then break. Without the breaks, we'd never finish a workout like that. And if we want to keep going in life, we need to learn how to break. We're made out of dust. Just like the Israelites had in their calendar, we too need regular times of refreshments. Maybe daily, weekly, monthly, annually. And so on a very practical note, for some of us this morning, that might mean fighting to get more sleep. Some of us here think that not sleeping is more godly, but it's not. God made us physical beings. We can't sleep. We can't go without sleep, without doing our bodies, let alone our souls, a great deal of harm. God made us to spend nearly a third of our lives on our backs, in a dark room, with our eyes closed. Very few of us can survive, let alone thrive, if we only get 4-5 hours sleep a night. Don Carson, who's one of the best Christian scholars in the world, he says that sleep deprivation doesn't just affect us physically, but also spiritually. And he says that sleep deprivation is one possible cause for doubt in the Christian life. And so he says that sometimes the best thing you can do in the universe is get a good night's sleep. Let me return to the theme of the Sabbath. Sabbath literally means rest, and it's a huge theme through the Bible. And it's not primarily about rules and regulations. The Sabbath is actually all about relationship. So do you remember how in the beginning God created the world in 6 days? And then on the seventh day, he rested. And God shared that rest with Adam and Eve. God walked with them in the garden. And the rest was never supposed to end. It was like Adam and Eve were on holiday with God forever. But then in the third chapter of the Bible, it went disastrously wrong. Adam and Eve rejected and ignored God. And as a result, they were punished, rightly. They were chucked out of the garden. And from that moment on, life was characterized by restlessness, hostility, pain, toil, sweat, thorns and thistles. Now, by the time we reach Exodus 16, God has rescued for himself a people, the nation of Israel, and he gives them this Sabbath command. In Exodus 20, it will become one of the Ten Commandments. Israel is God's nation, and he's leading them to the promised land, this country of refreshment and recuperation and relief. But we read Psalm 95, and it becomes clear that the promised land isn't the eternal rest that God has in mind. This promised land in the Old Testament is a shadow, and the substance is still to come. And then Jesus bursts onto the scene in the New Testament, and he says this, "Come to me, all you who are weary and burdened, and I will give you rest." Jesus says, "I am the Lord of the Sabbath." We read that and we don't really get it. Jesus is the Lord of the Sabbath. Okay. So we move on to something more exciting, or something that we think is more exciting. But what Jesus is saying when he says, "I am the Lord of the Sabbath," what he's announcing to the world is that he has come to deal with the restlessness. He will restore the creation. He will give us back the rest that Adam and Eve enjoyed. He will take us to be with him in paradise. When Jesus says he is the Lord of the Sabbath, it's massive. It's God himself coming with an invitation to an all-expenses-paid holiday with him for eternity. The Sabbath isn't about rules and regulations. It's about relationship with God and that relationship and rest being restored. Jesus has been raised from the dead. He's alive. He's already entered that rest. And one day, all those who trust in him, who know him as Lord and Savior, will go to be with him in a place of rest. If you've got a blue Bible, do turn with me to Hebrews chapter 4. It's on page 1203. Hebrews chapter 4, page 1203. So Hebrews chapter 4, have a look at verse 1. Therefore, since the promise of entering his rest, this is the eternal rest, still stands, let us be careful that none of you be found to have fallen short of it. And then scan down to verse 11. Let us therefore make every effort to enter that rest, so that no one will perish by following their example of disobedience. And when the writer here talks about their example in verse 11, he's referring to the people of Israel in the desert. Time and time and time again, the people of Israel ignore and reject God. Some of them paid no attention to the Lord. They kept bread when they shouldn't, and they woke up with maggots and bad smells in their tents. Even when they were told to rest, some of the people still go out on the seventh day in the search of bread. The people of Israel were what the Bible calls hard-hearted. And the writer to the Hebrews is urging us this morning not to be like them. So if you're not a Christian, this verse in Hebrews is a warning. Yes, the promise of eternal rest still stands. It's not too late. You can find out about Jesus. You can believe in Jesus. You can trust in him. But if you continue to follow in the footsteps of the Israelites, if you live your life ignoring and rejecting Jesus, disobeying his call to follow him, the consequences are frightening. You'll be excluded from this eternal rest. The word the writer to the Hebrews uses is perish. But if you're a Christian this morning, what do you think it means to make every effort to enter that rest? Make every effort. And for us to begin answering that question, we'll look at Exodus 16, the second command. This gives us some pointers. And it's a command to remember. So we had a command to rest, and now we've got a command to remember. Exodus 16, verses 31 to 36. Now, when you read through the chapter, it seems that this bread has mysterious properties, because from Sunday to Thursday, it lasts for less than 24 hours. It's spoils overnight. And then the manna that's collected on Friday lasts for just under 48 hours. But now a loaf of this bread is put in a jar and it lasts for years, for decades, for generations. Look at verse 32. Moses said, "This is what the Lord has commanded." So there's the second command. "Take an omer of manna and keep it for the generations to come, so that they can see the bread I gave you to eat in the wilderness when I brought you out of Egypt." So Moses said to Aaron, "Take a jar and put an omer of manna in it. Then place it before the Lord to be kept for the generations to come." An omer of manna weighs about 1.5 kilograms. It's got a volume of about 3.5 liters. So this isn't a jam jar that they sling in their backpack. This is a large container. It's supposed to be noticeable. And the reason the Lord gives them this second command is to help the Israelites remember. Now, for guys preparing for exams, I'm sure you'll be familiar with various revision techniques and memory aids, like sticking post-it notes around the house, or reading your notes in funny accents, or learning mnemonics. I've never forgotten this one. Tell me if you can see if you can spot what it's to help me remember. My very easy method just speeds up naming planets. Anyone know what that mnemonic's for? Planets, yes. So Mercury, Venus, Earth, Mars, Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, Neptune and Pluto. My very easy method just speeds up naming planets. When there's something we don't want to forget, we use these sort of techniques and tools to help us remember. And so here, the Lord gives the Israelites a visual aid, a box of bread that's never going to go moldy. Don't forget. He wants this generation, their children, their grandchildren, their great-grandchildren, and so on, to remember. And the question is, what does he want them to remember? Have another look at verse 32. Take this omer of manna and keep it for generations to come, so they see the bread I gave you to eat in the wilderness when I brought you out of Egypt. In years to come, the Lord never wants the people of Israel to forget that he is the one who saved them and who sustains them. He set their ancestors free from Egypt, and he supplied them with all they needed on their journey. This bread would cause the people to look back. It would be a reminder of all that the Lord had done in the past. A reminder of the epic story of Exodus, from slavery to freedom. But as well as the bread causing them to look back, the provision of this bread was meant to make them look forward, to remind them of where they were going, the promised land. I don't know if you noticed when the reading was read, but in verse 31, we're told what the bread tasted like. It tasted like wafers made with honey. Now, those little details aren't just there to make the story more colourful, they're significant. The Israelites, back in Exodus chapter 3, had been told that the promised land would be good and spacious, and it would be a land flowing with milk and honey. So each mouthful of manna was a foretaste of the future. This is what you can expect, Israel, and much more when you arrive at your final destination, the promised land. It will be amazing. Do you see, this command to remember points them back and points them forward. Remember the past and remember the future. And for Christians, as we've already mentioned, the Old Testament, these stories are shadows of the substance that is to come. In John chapter 6, Jesus says this, "I am the bread of life. Whoever comes to me will never go hungry, and whoever believes in me will never be thirsty. I am the living bread that came down from heaven. Whoever eats this bread will live forever. This bread is my flesh, which I will give for the life of the world." It's a pretty graphic picture. But Jesus is saying that he came to save and to sustain, just like the manna in the desert, but in a far greater way. When you look at John 6, he isn't just talking about the nation of Israel, but for the world. And he uses the word whoever. Whoever comes to me, whatever you've done, wherever you've screwed up your life, Jesus came for you. And whoever believes in him, whoever feeds on him by faith, whoever trusts in him, we're not just going to be nourished temporarily, but permanently. Jesus offers life forever, eternal rest with him in paradise. So how do you and I make every effort to enter that rest? We too must be people who look back, who remember the past, and who look forward and who remember the future. Look back at Jesus, the one who was torn like a piece of bread. His body was ripped apart. He was beaten and flogged and crucified. For me and for you, if you believe in him. For all who believe in him, he gave himself. So be here on Sunday mornings, particularly when we celebrate times of communion, when we really focus on and remember the past and that event in his life, his death. Remember the past, look back. But also, we need to be people who are looking forwards. Like the Israelites, we're on this journey. We're the traveling people of God. The here and now isn't our final destination. Our home address isn't somewhere in Bristol, England. But our home address is in the new creation, where there will be no more restlessness. where physically, emotionally, spiritually, in body, mind, and soul, believers in Jesus will know peace. God will wipe every tear from our eyes. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old order of things will have passed away. Why don't we take a moment's quiet, then we'll sing.